From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a dashing hero, a dark villain, great escapes, and yes, romance. Best-selling author of The House of Spirits, Isabel Allende packs it all into her unexpected new novel, Zorro. In her hands, Diego de la Vega grows from a young prankster with big ears to the masked Zorro of lore. Tonight on Point, Zorro rides again in a new novel by Isabel Allende. But first tonight, we begin with breaking news on Capitol Hill. Joining me now from Washington is Gail Shattuck, congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. She's been attending a press conference where a group of moderate senators have announced a kind of breakthrough in this so-called nuclear option issue around judicial nominees and the Senate filibuster. Gail, thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh, glad to be here.
I know you're tumbling straight out of this briefing. We've just heard the kind of summary, the news at the top of the hour, but tell us exactly what's been announced here.
Basically, two elements. Commitments on pending judicial nominations include both Democrats and Republicans agreeing to vote to end debate on three nominees, Janice Rogers Brown up for the D.C. Circuit, William Pryor for the 11th, and Priscilla Owen for the 5th Circuit. That is, of course, the vote that precipitated all of this. She's going to come up for a cloture vote tomorrow at noon.
Mm-hmm.
So if an agreement was to come, it had to be now. As to the other nominees, they made no commitment on William Myers for the 9th Circuit or Henry Sodd for the 6th.
That is no commitment that they would, the Democrats, that they would not filibuster in
exactly.
those cases.
The interesting part is the commitments for future nominations, and this really was a real sticking point. The signatories agreed that they would only filibuster under extraordinary circumstances, and that each signatory would really use their own discretion as to whether those circumstances exist, and that in light of those commitments, they would not agree to any amendment or interpretation of the Senate that would force a vote on a judicial nomination by means other than unanimous consent or Rule 22, meaning they would not agree to a nuclear option. Now, all of that depends, of course, on the faith of the signatories.
On the faith, the good faith of the signatories. Now, Gail, let me ask you, does this mean, then, that the so-called, that the filibuster of these nominees, this is not the entire Senate that has signed this, so
no.
Does it mean that the filibuster is off? Does it mean that Bill Frist's nuclear option is necessarily off? Are there enough senators here that that is now a sure thing, that those are both not going to happen tomorrow?
It's not going to happen tomorrow, that we know for sure. What's interesting, Tom, also, is we've talked about this group as the Gang of 12. I'm not sure why. It's always been very fluid. But in the end, there were 14. So it's an even heavier commitment at the center than existed before. I think that there is something new that happened in the last half hour. The Senate, for quite some time now, has been going in the direction more like the House, where the leaders make the key determinations. What's interesting here is that the leaders on both sides were effectively repudiated. The center said, look, we've come to a precipice. The institution of the Senate is at stake. We don't agree to go along. Lindsey Graham, senator from South Carolina.
Republican,
put it in a very interesting way. He said, there are several things that have just happened. One, there are judges that are going to get votes that wouldn't otherwise have gotten votes.
Mm-hmm.
And two, for a while, I'm going to get some calls from my constituents who are going to be very upset with me. But he and I think the other Republicans on whom there was tremendous pressure, because they are stepping away from their leadership on an issue that is central to Bill Frist's future and leadership. It's also central to the conservatives in their own party. And they're saying they're doing it because the future of the Senate was at stake.
And Bill Frist's presidential aspirations have been interpreted by many as hinging on him leading this thing through. Is he damaged in those aspirations in his Senate leadership by this or not?
Well, it depends. I have always thought that a no vote would be very damaging to him. Now, it depends on, for the primary, his critical relationships are with the base conservative groups. If he can represent this as a valiant fight, that he was stabbed in the back by what
John McCain, for example,
referred to as rhinos, Republicans in name only,
mm-hmm.
then he could perhaps galvanize a move to get rid of them, to get real Republicans in there and put himself at the head of that cause. But my own sense is that there were so many mistakes and tumbles along the way for the leadership on both sides. They box themselves into a corner and threw up their hands. It's very bad in the middle of a fight as intense as this to lose leadership, to have all the press crowding around people who are not in leadership, including, you know, it was interesting in this group you had among the Democrats, the most senior Democrat, Robert Byrd, and the least senior Democrat, Ken Salazar.
Right, and so, but this remains a temporary solution, Gail.
Absolutely. No, this is a Band-Aid. But what I think is interesting about it, and why I think there is something genuinely new here, is the assertion of muscle from the center. Now, all of the stories about, you know, about the center recently has been like you were describing, you know, a dangerously extinct species.
Mm-hmm.
They're back. The rumors of their death were premature.
Mm. Well, we've seen it tonight on Capitol Hill in Washington, and the whole shape of the drama there appears to be significantly changing just in the course of the last hour. We'll be following this tomorrow, I'm sure. Gail Chadwick, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Gail Chadwick, congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. She joined me from Washington. In her new novel, Isabel Allende brings back the masked hero, Zorro, with his smoldering good looks, keen sense of justice, and that flashing sword. Allende made her reputation with lyrical epics that made her the first woman to break into the top tier of Latin American literary figures. Now, she's picked up a character born in dime novels almost a century ago. Allende is not the first to revive Zorro, the hero created by Johnston McCulley. In 1919, the former police reporter created Zorro in the serialized novel The Curse of Capistrano. Douglas Fairbanks brought Zorro to the big screen in 1920. Walt Disney brandished his version in a 1957 television series. CBS had a Zorro cartoon. And in 1998, Antonio Banderas and Catherine Zeta-Jones turned up the heat in The Mask of Zorro. A sequel comes out this fall, and now here's Allende's Zorro in the hands of a master. Tonight on Point, Zorro rides again in a new novel by Isabel Allende. You can join our conversation tonight. What has Zorro's mark been on your imagination? Are you surprised to find the pulp fiction hero in the hands of Isabel Allende? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Isabel Allende. She's one of the most internationally popular novelists of the last two decades. Her books have been translated into more than 25 languages. She's author of The House of Spirits and Eva Luna. Her new book is Zorro. Isabel Allende, wonderful to have you back with us on Point. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I have to say, the last time we were talking, you were writing about Chile and your childhood and complex politics and complex family history. And now we find you with none other than Zorro. What put you on this Camino Real, on this road, Isabel Allende?
Well, actually, it wasn't my idea. I was planning another novel, a historical novel placed in Chile, and then Zorro jumped my balcony. I wasn't expecting him at all, but this handsome, athletic young man climbed my balcony and asked me to write about his first 20 years, the origins of the legend.
Right, so we're going back. It's kind of the prequel, in a sense, or the fleshing out of the early days of Zorro. Americans, I guess the world has become very familiar with this kind of treatment from Star Wars and everything else.
He's known all over the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, Zorro is known in China. 64% of the population in China know who he is.
When you say he climbed your balcony, of course, it came in the form of a visiting party from the company that owns the right to Zorro, and they wanted you to bring him to full life in a novel, which I guess has never exactly been done.
Yes, there is a company that owns the copyright, and they came to my house in August of 2003, and they said they had done everything with Zorro except a work of literature. And I said, excuse me, I'm a serious writer. I felt very offended.
Right.
But then they left a box with all the videos and of course, the Mask of Zorro and posters of Antonio Banderas, and I couldn't resist. So I started researching the time, which is a wonderful time, the beginning of the 1800s.
This is Spanish California.
In California, there were only cows, Indians, and some missionaries. Mm-hmm. Nothing was happening in California. But in the rest of the world, in Europe, It was a time of the expansion of the ideas of the French Revolution, a time where, when the world, the Western world, was changing. So I took my sorrow, 15 years old, and sent him with Bernardo, his milk brother, to Spain, where he gets an education and he becomes Sorrow.
And we will hear about those origins, the trip to Spain and all the rest. I mean, this is a real eye-popping. We've got pirates, sword fights, musket balls flying and all the rest. Isabel Allende, did you feel yourself in writing the story of Zorro migrating into the pulp fiction world of his origins or pulling Zorro into your literary world?
Oh, I didn't even think of the pulp fiction world. I just brought him to the kind of novels I write. I wanted an epic saga with everything there, family, politics, strong women, magic, everything that I've read about.
And what kind of man did you find in Zorro?
Goofy.
Vain,
athletic, idealistic, very young and tender heart. I loved him. He was just a kid.
Well, we're going to come back. We're going to hear.
And also, he has big ears. You know?
big ears. We learn among other things in your novel that mask tied around the head plays a dual role, a little bit of a disguise, and it holds down those ears. Something I really had never thought about. Isabel Allende, it's wonderful to have you tonight. We're looking forward to really digging in here with you. We're talking with the novelist Isabel Allende about Zorro writing again. She's out with a new novel, a treatment. It is Zorro, and it takes us back to the even before the birth of Zorro, fills in all the blanks with a real towering figure in Latin American literary culture. You can join us tonight. What has Zorro's mark been on your imagination? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the masked hero of Spanish California, Zorro, riding again in a new novel by Isabel Allende. Isabel Allende is with us tonight. The new novel is simply Zorro, and it's catching attention all over the place. Zorro never seems to fail, neither does she. You can join our conversation tonight. Are you surprised to find this pulp fiction hero in the hands of Isabel Allende? And what is it about this character, Zorro, that is apparently so timeless? What do you expect in a Zorro written by this author, the creator of The House of Spirits and Eva Luna? What do you expect of a Zorro written by a daughter of Latin America? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Isabel Allende, it's always wonderful talking with you, and we're so happy to have you with us tonight. If you'd be good enough, I'd like to, just for a moment, stick with this moment when you crossed over to an interest in Zorro, when, as you put it, the young man climbed your balcony. We have with us one of the people from the group that owns the rights to Zorro, and I want to bring her in for a moment, if I may. Sandra Curtis joins us. She's with Zorro Productions, Inc. She was part of a group that approached Isabel Allende about writing on Zorro. She is the former wife of John Gertz. His father, there's an interesting history here. His father, in the 1920s, bought the rights to Zorro from the original author, Johnston McCulley. She's a senior vice president at Zorro Productions, Inc., and author of Zorro Unmasked, the Official History. She joins us tonight. Sandra Curtis, thanks so much for being with us.
And thank you for including me. Hi, Isabel.
Hello, Sandra. How are you?
So tell us what took you to the door of the author of The House of Spirits and so many other real literary works 2 years ago in 2003 to write a new version of Zorro, Sandra Curtis.
Well, it was our hope that we could find a writer who could bring a real authentic voice to this Hispanic hero. And what better writer we could never have thought of than Isabel. And the fact that she said yes has created a wonderful opportunity in history for us, and it's just been an absolute pleasure to get to know her.
Take us back to the very origins. Johnston McCulley, 1919. Who was he when he wrote this? The first, what turned out to be the first Zorro episode, The Curse of Capistrano. Who was Johnston McCulley? How did he come up with this character?
Well, Johnston McCulley wrote for the pulp novels, and these were, if you imagine, the soap operas of their day. So for 10 cents, anybody could buy a grand adventure that would have action and drama in a tremendously fascinating locale. And Johnston McCulley lived in Southern California. He had been a former newspaper writer and police reporter, mm-hmm. as you had mentioned previously, Tom. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody really knows why he picked up this character, why he was fascinated, although we do know that he did research at the Santa Barbara Mission. California was a wonderful time during the Spanish period. It was romantic, and to create a hero of the people was a grand opportunity. And so McCulley created this character. He, however, didn't have any idea that this character would have the popularity or the longevity that Zorro has had, and unmasked the character at the end of his first story. And
put that mask back on.
That's right. And at the end, after Fairbanks made the very, very popular movie, The Mark of Zorro,
which was just the next year, 1920.
Right. And you may know this piece of history. It's rather romantic, which sort of fits the character of this romantic California hero. Douglas Fairbanks had married Mary Pickford. They were the silent film stars of the day. And on their honeymoon, which was a transatlantic voyage, he had taken McCulley's Curse of Capistrano and set that actually film into motion when they were on their honeymoon.
Wow. the romance never ends here.
That's right. And so after the popularity of the film, there was a demand for more stories. So what does a creative writer do? Masks his hero once again, gives the town collective amnesia, and revives the villain that he had killed off, and goes on to write 65 more Zorro stories until 1958, the year of his death.
And on it went in multiple movies and multiple treatments of almost every kind until you get this kind of treatment that Isabel Allende has given us. Isabel Allende, when you made this deal, finally, to come in and write about Zorro, was anything asked of you? Were there any minimal requirements of the way you characterize Zorro, or did you make any requirements of the people who, amazingly enough, own Zorro?
Well, I was writing about the first 20 years, so that's before he becomes Zorro. Mm-hmm. So the only requirement was that by the end of the novel, we would have a young man dressed in black with a whip, a sword, and a mask, and that I would not betray him as the idealistic Avenger that we know.
And indeed, you didn't, Sandra Curtis. Any surprises in the Zorro that Isabel Allende produced?
She created Toypurnia, Diego's mother, as a Native American warrior, which was a fabulous innovation. We were just delighted when she said, "What do you think about this?" We all just went, "Fabulous, fabulous!" So that was a wonderful part of the treatment. All the drama that she included in Spain that was going on, the historical part that played into how Diego becomes the masked hero Zorro, was just masterfully done. And, of course, the integration of the shaman grandmother, mm-hmm. White Owl. Really created this sense of the earthiness of the character and the land and this connection and roots that this young man Diego had to the land of California and the heritage of the indigenous people, and laid the foundation for his sense of fighting for justice and against the injustice that he had seen as a young boy against the Native people.
Well, lucky Zorro Productions to get Zorro up on Isabel Allende's balcony of all places, and lucky us to have a little glimpse into the history of the Zorro story tonight from you. Sandra Curtis, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
So, Isabel Allende, I wish you'd give us a sense of where your Zorro comes from. Sandra Curtis began to describe it there. But for most of us, he's a grown man when we know him, and you've taken him all the way back to pre-birth. We got just a little flavor there, but describe the Zorro that you put on this earth, his origins. Who is he? Where does he come from?
Well, I took up a real character, a historical character called Toypurnia. This was a young warrior, a young female warrior from a Shoshone tribe, the only time that the tribes got together and were able to rebel against the missionaries and the Spanish presence in California was under the leadership of this young woman. Mm. And so I imagined that a woman like that would be Zorro's mother, and the father, a Spanish soldier.
And
in real life, mm-hmm. this woman was taken captive by the Spanish troops, and she became Christian, and eventually she did marry a Spanish soldier. So the story was just there, waiting to be told.
It's a very dramatic first encounter between them, not the kind that in most cases leads to love, marriage, and raising children together.
They meet in battle.
Right, very intimately in battle, and not in a romantic sense. But soon comes a boy, and paint a picture of the old California into which this young Diego is born, Diego de la Vega.
Diego is born in a very privileged household. His father had become the richest and most powerful hacendado, that's the landowner in Southern California near what is today Los Angeles. And they had a beautiful property, and his mother, Regina, was this sort of aloof woman who would escape often to her tribe. He was raised riding horses and swimming in the sea, very athletic and very free, a free spirit, always accompanied by a character that I love in the book, my favorite character, his brother. He's not his blood brother, he is a spiritual brother, Bernardo. Bernardo is a character that was already in the TV series that we've all seen.
Mm-hmm.
But in the TV series, he was a sort of clown, deaf, mute. I never liked him.
Yes.
He was just clownish. Here, he's a tragic character.
We'll talk about why Bernardo's a tragic character, but his mother, Anna, plays an important role. Zorro and Bernardo suckle at the same breast, making them, in your phrase, milk brothers.
Well, it's a Spanish saying. We say hermano de leche, meaning that it's like blood brother when you are nursed by the same woman.
I wonder if I could prevail upon you to read just a little bit for us here about so that kind of sets the scene with some of the justice issues. A scene here where young Zorro, or Diego de la Vega's mother, who's of course Shoshone, but also goes by the name Regina, and she's chafing under the kind of life she's leading with his father, Alejandro de la Vega. Can you set this scene for us and read something, Isabel Allende?
Okay. Regina is married, has the child, but she's not very happy. Regina went back to her long horseback rides with her son in a kind of papoose basket on her back, and she lost the slight interest she'd had in domestic chores. She fell into her old habit of visiting the Indians, even those not on their ranch, with the aim of identifying their problems and, if possible, easing them. As the colonists continued to divide up the land and subdue the tribes of the region, a system of obligatory service developed that was different from slavery, only in that the Indians, too, were subjects of the King of Spain, and in theory had certain rights. In practice, they were dirt poor. They worked in exchange for food, liquor, tobacco, and permission to raise a few animals. In general, the ranchers were benevolent patriarchs, most interested in their pleasures and passions than in the land and their peons. But occasionally, a rancher came along who had a bad temper, and then the indiada, as the Indian population was called, went hungry or was pitiless beaten. The neophytes at the mission were just as poor. They lived with their families in round huts built on sticks and straw. They worked from sun up to sunset, and they were totally dependent on the mission brothers for their livelihood. Alejandro de la Vega tried to be a good patron, but it annoyed him that Regina kept asking for more for the Indians, even after he had explained to her that they could not treat them any differently from those on other ranches, because that would cause problems in the colony. Padre Mendoza and Regina, unified by the same desire to protect the Indians, had become friends. He had forgiven her for attacking the mission, and she was grateful because he had brought Diego into the world. The patrones stayed out of their way. The missionary had moral authority, and she was the wife of the alcalde. On the occasions that Regina wanted to launch one of her campaigns for justice, she dressed in Spanish style, combed her hair into a severe bun, wore an amethyst cross upon her breast, and attended functions in an elegant carriage, a gift from her husband, abandoning the spirited mare she usually rode. Even so, she was coolly received because she was not one of them. No rancher would admit to having an Indian ancestor. To a man, they claim Spanish heritage, white skin, and pure blood. That Regina did not even try to hide her origins was not something they could forgive.
Isabel Allende, reading from her new novel, Zorro. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Bill's calling from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill, you're on the air.
Thank you. It's wonderful, wonderful concept in this novel, Miss Allende. Thank you for letting me comment. A comment and a question, really. My son is just going back to Peru to do some work on the historiography of Machu Picchu and the American connection with Hiram Bingham, and so I hope he isn't embarrassed by this, but my reaction to Zorro was really formed when I was a young man in Wisconsin and watching the TV show and reading the comic book in the 50s. And what astonished me, and there were Mexican-Americans working, migrants working in the area, was the fact that probably because of his, well, you can tell me why, but because of his character, and we all thought that Zorro was absolutely wonderful and marvelous, and there was no stigma attached of any notion of what was Hispanic or misunderstandings of it. This was just a spectacular person. And suddenly he just vanished, and the image was replaced by, well, there was a clownish image in Zorro's escapade. Some of the Spanish soldiers were rather, I use the word buffoons, and they were, you know, clearly foils for his brilliance. But he just, what struck me is he just vanished. But there's this wonderfully kind of complex perception that we, you know, of things that we, was really untainted by kind of north-south prejudice, I guess, or is it probably a better way of putting it. But when I taught university much later in Papua New Guinea in the late 70s, early 80s, and I had a very good colleague who was a supporter of your father, Ms. Allende, Luis, I won't mention his last name, who's now gone, but he had left Chile before that. But
were they reading Zorro in Papua New Guinea, Bill?
No, but the point was is that they were black and white readers alike, expatriates and Papua New Guineans, absolutely adored the Phantom and, what's the other, the Phantom and one other, you know, one that you would think would be...
Probably Superman. Superman and Zorro.
they go together. Bill, we hear your fandom there, right around the world in those settings. And I guess, Isabel Allende, what Bill brings to mind is, first, he says, what about the ethnic issues implicit in the Zorro story and how you treat them? We'll think about how you compare him to other superheroes as well, but let's just start there. Is Zorro, to your mind, a Hispanic hero? Is he a Native American hero? Is he an American hero?
To me, he's mestizo. He's a mixture of the Native American, the Spanish, Mexican. He belongs to both cultures. And he has a great sense of social justice. And therefore, he crosses borders in many ways. He's not black or white or brown. He's just, I don't know, he's a free soul.
He turned out to have, in your telling and many others, kind of nomadic life, very often an outsider in this way, not so different from your own history, leaving Chile under Pinochet. And your relatives, of course, Salvador Allende, meeting a bad end there, and you become a kind of a global picaresque traveler in some way yourself.
Yes, my life has been about moving from one place to another, and I don't think I would be a fiction writer today without the military coup in Chile that forced me out of my country. I think that my writing is an exercise in memory, an attempt to recover many things that I have lost along the way.
And did you see Zorro then as a hero in political terms, trying to set things right?
Yes, I always set my stories in a political context because I think that politics affect everybody's life. And for me, it's impossible to avoid it in my writing. So for me, Zorro is a mixture of Robin Hood and Che Guevara, and he has also a lot of Peter Pan. He never grows up. He's always a child in many ways, a young boy.
romance and always that fun, that Peter Pan angle as well. Yeah. Isabel Allende, please stick with us. We're so delighted to have you tonight. We want to learn more about your characterization of the early years of, I have to say, a hero I never expected to see with your name next to him, but it's a charming pairing, and it's a wonderful story that you weave. Isabel Allende's new novel is Zorro. Zorro riding again with us tonight. We're at 1-800-423-8255. You can join the conversation. Ladies, be honest. Is Zorro the man of your dreams? Gentlemen, is the masked hero the one you'd like to be? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the masked hero of old Spanish California, Zorro, riding again in a new novel by Isabel Allende. It is entitled simply Zorro, and it's a rollicking big picaresque that takes Diego de la Vega from before his birth in old California, all across California, all around the world, to Spain and back. It's got pirates and love and sword fighting and everything you'd expect in a Zorro story, plus the touch that maybe only Isabel Allende would bring to it. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you expect in a Zorro written by this author, the creator of The House of Spirits and Eva Luna? What's your question for the new author of Zorro Daring Do, Isabel Allende? And maybe there's this. What would Zorro think of the landscape of power and justice in America, in California, today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Isabel Allende, you describe Zorro as the father of all superheroes, Batman, Superman, you name them, all those that have a kind of double personality. What do you mean by that?
Well, after Zorro, we have had all those superheroes that have a mask and they change their personality. They seem very shy in normal life and then they put on this costume and they become somebody else. And they're all superheroes fighting for justice. The difference with Zorro is that Zorro is just smart, brave and athletic. And all the others have magic tricks or technology or
so
whatever.
Supernatural powers.
Supernatural powers. They rely on those supernatural powers, not Zorro. He's just a person. And I think that's why every little boy dresses up like Zorro and relates to Zorro, because he feels, or she feels sometimes, a girl, that they can be Zorro. It's just a matter of daring.
Mm. He does have a secret, we won't give it away here, that helps us understand how he can be quite so amazing in his daring do. But in that double personality, how did you come to define the two faces of Zorro, the one without the mask, the one with the mask? What are those two personalities?
In many of the TV series and some of the stories that have been told about Zorro, he is a little almost feminine in the when he's not Zorro. I mean, he plays the dandy, mm-hmm, in the other characterization. I didn't want that yet because he's very young, and I thought, no, well, I'm going to make him rather goofy and vain and a personality that is more flaky in many ways. He's very hyperactive, theatrical. He wants to be always the center of attention. And he's very impulsive, and he takes risks that he shouldn't take. And there is always his brother to pull him back and to protect him.
Bernardo, so mute, and you're telling mute for a shocking reason.
Yes.
But really, really, in many ways, Zorro's peer.
Well, he's the other side of Zorro. Just as Zorro is extroverted, Bernardo is introverted. And Bernardo is rooted to the Indian tradition, to the land, to the spirit world. And he's always there like an invisible angel that protects Zorro. And by making them so different, I could highlight both kids in the story.
And the transformation of Zorro that he undertakes when the mask goes on, what is it? How do you describe it?
Then he becomes, first of all, he's funny. And he's defiant, ironic. He's extremely brave. But he is not violent. He doesn't kill the opponent. Most of the time, he just humiliates the opponent. And he says that in the novel several times, that he's fine if he can just humiliate the adversary, not necessarily kill him. And that's why my villain, Rafael Moncado, always gets away with whatever is happening.
But Zorro, the most famous thing about Zorro, of course, is his whoosh, whoosh, whoosh
zine
that he leaves on the side of the building. In your telling, he also leaves it on the bodies of those that he humiliates.
But that's not my making, because I've seen that in many of the movies.
How do you interpret that, though? Is there a sadistic side to this Zorro? Is that revenge for the injustice that these adversaries have imposed on others? Why the sword, you know, carving a Z in the flesh of his opponents?
I mean, the opponents deserve it. Absolutely deserve it. They've done horrible things. So the least they can have is a Z, I think. I would have killed them. I would have killed them, but he doesn't. He just carves the Z.
He's a kinder hero than his author in this case.
Absolutely.
Raymond is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Raymond. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Greetings, and thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I think this is just absolutely wonderful how Miss Allende has kind of legitimized Zorro from his beginnings in the pulps. Because I remember as a child myself, I used to watch the rebroadcast of the old cliffhanger serials when they were on the UHF channels. And I'd see those old black and whites, and then, you know, we'd see him in a bit of danger, and then, you know, we have to wait till next week to see how he gets out of it.
Right.
And
wasn't that horrible, the
waiting? It was. I couldn't wait. I was very impatient. And I was wondering, this is wonderful that you've created this entire backstory that was probably lacking from the original conception of the character. Well, now that we know his true origins, are you going to carry this further in new novels his youth becoming full-fledged Zorro?
Are we going to see 65 Zorro books from Isabel Allende?
Well, actually, I'm not going to do that, but there are other authors that are doing it. A person in Spain and Jan Atkins in the United States, they are creating, I think that it's like 30 books for kids about the origins of Zorro, him as a child.
He just can't be killed. It sounds, Raymond, that you've got plenty of appetite remaining.
Very much so, yes. I know that there have been many movies based on him, and I know one where you point out where Ricardo Montalban played a evil, he was the colonel or some marshal or something.
All right.
And at the last, where he finds out who Zorro truly is, he goes, "Oh, I thought you had the soul of a peacock. When it's true, you had the soul of a hawk," because he was playing the dandy. But I always thought that was, well, he had to mask who he truly was, his true spirit.
Mm. Raymond, thanks for your call.
I think that Zorro is a Gemini, and he just changes his personality. He has two personalities.
But I would think, from the way you tell it again, you take him into the woods where he's looking for visions, he's looking for inspiration, and it comes from the fox, which, of course, fox Zorro in Spanish.
Yes.
Neither peacock nor hawk,
but Zorro.
And but
he
Zorro,
takes
the fox.
Upon himself the characteristics of the fox. He's smart, he is hiding, he works at night, he's a hunter. It's very, very interesting because in that vision quest, he and Bernardo find the totemic animals. Mm. For Zorro, it's the fox, of course, and for Bernardo, it's a different animal. Mm. So it's a horse. It's really interesting how, by looking at the characteristics of the animal, you can create the character.
They're a very Native American cultural reference, but you get Zorro and Bernardo, for that matter, back into old Spain in the time of Napoleon and put him deep in the thick. His father Alejandro sends him back for kind of polishing up, and he finds himself very deep in European politics and civil strife there. Why did you take him back to Europe?
Because, as I said before, everything was happening in Europe. And when he gets to Spain, Spain is occupied by Napoleonic troops. It's an interesting time in history because it was the first time that we had what we call today guerrillas. And in Spanish is guerrilla, which means a small war, little war. And the Spanish people could not fight the French. The army could not fight the French, but they started attacking them from behind at night to the point that eventually they drove him out of the country. So it's a fascinating time.
Let's get one more call. Peter's calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious about one thing. If she thought it was interesting that Zorro, being biracial, found that was he compelled to defend the Indians against the Spanish, or was it just something he felt an injustice based on his mother's influence?
Isabel Allende.
Well, I think that sorrow would stand for anybody who is the underdog, anybody who is unfairly treated. I think it wouldn't matter to Soro the color of the skin or the ethnic background. He would fight for anyone who needs an avenger, who needs someone, a hero to fight for them.
He's a hero after all. Peter, thanks for your call. Isabel Allende, I have to put it to you. I mean, you have lived in California for many years now. And I've read you saying that when you're in your Lexus going down the freeway, you're a woman of substance and means, and you're in your fine house there. When you're on the street, you are a Latina. If you put Zorro in California today, what your Zorro, the Zorro you've imagined, what do you think he would see? Who would he be sticking up for, making his Z on the wall for?
I think he would stick up for the immigrants, for many people who come to California looking for work and working very, very hard and are mistreated, and I think he would stand for them. You know, where I live is probably one of the most one of the wealthiest counties in the country. And it's divided by a canal. And the people who live on the other side are immigrants, many of them, most of them, Hispanic. And you see them standing there in the corner for hours and hours waiting for a job. And they have no rights. They have nothing. And you see these small people, dark people, humble people who are willing to work for nothing because they are desperate. I think Zorro would stand for them.
And do you see a Zorro out there in American culture today? A real Zorro?
I see many, many Zorros, anonymous Zorros, women and men who dedicate their lives to service. And those are the Zorros of today, although they are not as flashy and as sexy as as Antonio Banderas is.
So sexy, but I have to say at the end, in this one, he doesn't exactly get the girl the way he'd like, not
because
in Isabel Allende's treatment.
No, because there's someone even sexier that comes across, Jean Lafitte.
The great pirate comes sailing
of
in.
Of course.
And Zorro, he who ties his ears back with his mask, can't quite surmount that. I guess we won't feel too sorry for him. We've all seen Antonio Banderas get the girl in the later movies, so we know he goes on to greater things on the romantic conquest front. Isabel Allende, it's always wonderful speaking with you, and we appreciate your being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the new book. Isabel Allende, Chilean by birth, American by residence, and now, after years of novels that have won literary acclaim right around the world, her new novel is Zorro. Takes him from before birth right up to young manhood. Isabel Allende, thanks for being with us. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org, click on forums. In a moment, Afghan President Hamid Karzai's message for the class of 2005. This is On Point. President Bush today rebuffed Afghan President Hamid Karzai's request for more authority over U.S. troops in Afghanistan during a meeting at the White House. Karzai brought a list of issues to the meeting. In addition to wanting more military control, he wants custody of Afghan prisoners held in the United States and more assistance in fighting the booming Afghan opium trade. President Bush said the prisoners would be transferred over time. Yesterday, President Karzai was in Boston, speaking at Boston University's commencement. Karzai told the class of 2005 that nations should consider the needs of the rest of the world and not only their narrowly defined national interests. Throughout the month, we've been bringing you notable commencement addresses from around the country. Here is Afghan President Hamid Karzai.
My own commencement some 23 years ago was also a stepping stone, but to a different future. After my graduation, I had no home to return because my home country had been invaded by the former Soviet Union. From university, I was ushered into the life of a refugee in a neighboring country, where I joined with my people in the struggle to liberate our country and to build a peaceful and prosperous Afghanistan. A lot has changed in the world since I was your age, but regrettably, the world is still beset by conflict, by poverty and human suffering, by injustice that violates the basic values of humanity. You are the class that began in September 2001, and as such, you have been provoked perhaps more so than others to reflect on one of the gravest dangers facing our world today, terrorism. I believe for most of you, the dreadful memory of that ominous day will never fade. However, terrorism in the world was not born on 9/11. In fact, for many years before September 2001, terrorism that came to Afghanistan on the heels of invasion, interference, and violence took the lives of thousands of our people. Regrettably, the world, the United States, and other countries that had the power and hence the responsibility did not see it compatible with their national interests to address the plight of the Afghan people then. Afghanistan was thus left vulnerable to the interference of other countries in our region, who in turn saw their national interests in establishing control over Afghanistan at the cost of horrible suffering for the Afghan people. I expect that you will use your education and your values to question some of the established concepts of wisdom. In particular, I urge you to question the notion of national interest, especially when it is narrowly defined and pursued at the expense of other people, where it justifies the inflicting of pain on others and where it allows the neglect of human suffering. I urge you to discover how moral imperative must also drive our actions even when there are no economic or political motives. I believe a redefinition of the prevailing notion of national interest on the basis of a fundamental moral premise is the way forward to our common future. After all, it is our humanity that ultimately brings us together, while the pursuit of narrow interest divides us all.
Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai delivering the commencement address at Boston University yesterday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.